The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Financial technology, or fintech, is one of the fastest growing industries in the world today, with New York, London, Tel Aviv, Edinburgh, Singapore, Moscow, and other major cities all vying for a piece of the action. Welcome to Breaking Banks, the first dedicated radio show that focuses on how this new boom is changing everything from the way we bank to the very concept of money itself. Now, here's your host, Brett King.
Hey, welcome to Breaking Banks. This is actually not Brett King. Ron Shevlin here, sitting in for Brett today. Going to host, and we've got a great show today. I think it's really timely, some really timely topics. Before we do that, though, we've got a couple of conference announcements to make. We're pretty excited. We're going to be doing the show live from the Mobile Payments Conference, August 28th through 30th. Brett will be there on stage with Travis Delaney, who's going to be here in a few minutes. He's CEO of Push Payments, and Dan Gonzalez, VP of Payment Industry Relations for the Federal Reserve Bank of Chicago. And then probably my favorite conference, Finovate, returns to New York September 11th through 14th. New format this year. They're expanding the agenda. It's going to be 4 days. You can register now at a pretty long URL that our producer gave me. But I'll tell you, if you just go to finovate.com, look up on the upper left-hand side, there's a little button there for the New York conference. And you can click on that to register. If you do, don't forget to use the special promotional code BREAKINGBANKS20. You'll save 20% on the current ticket price. Brett, of course, will be there on stage. And then later on in September, Next Money Chicago. I'll be there speaking, as will many of the Breaking Banks family. Brett, J.P. Nichols, Jim Marus, Jason Henricks, Dwayne Blomstrom. It's going to be a pretty good agenda. Go to nextmoney.org to register today. And last but not least, BAI Beacon in Atlanta on October 4th and 5th. For the second year in a row, Matteo Rizzi will be there with his FinTech track. And don't forget to get a discount code B32, or use the discount code B32 to get a discount on registration. Oh, yeah, and also forgot to mention, we, Breaking Banks, will be the exclusive podcaster for Money 2020 in Las Vegas. Breaking Banks, FinTech 5, The Serial Entrepreneur, and a couple of new podcasts that we'll be launching pretty soon. My own FinTech Snark Tank and FemTech will be there. Brett will be a keynote speaker. Look for us at The Pod. We'll be doing many shows throughout the event. And I also really want to thank NTT Data for graciously sponsoring us for that. So if you missed any of that, don't forget, you can go to the sponsors conference partner pages at breakingbanks.com for any of that. But let's get right into our show for today and some of the hot topics. I don't know if you noticed last week, Amazon announced a new feature to its Amazon Pay product and service called Amazon Pay Places. And help us make some sense of it and what the impact of it's going to be. We're going to bring on Brian Romley from Payfinders.com and Multiplex. Brian, you there?
How you doing, Ron? Thank you for having me today.
Oh, great. I'm glad to finally be getting a chance to talk with you in person. We've interacted a lot through social media and so forth, but I don't know if we've ever had a chance to connect live like this, so thanks a lot for that. Brian, I want to ask you a lot about Amazon Pay Places and what you think the impact's going to be. But for the listeners, and you've been on the show before, who might have missed your previous guest appearances here, tell us a little bit about Payfinders and what you do.
Well, Payfinders is the largest Apple Pay map in the world. It's one of those things that you just don't think about until you start trying to use Apple Pay. You realize that it's a bit of a challenge. And so back before Apple Pay came out, I decided that it was one of the easiest ways for Apple Pay to be surfaced was to create a map. And it's doing exceedingly well. Over the last couple of months, I've also started readmultiplex.com. It's also an iOS app and an Android app. And it's sort of surfacing some of my ideas about how payments, voice commerce, and even quantum computing is going to take over in the future. So it's a whole combination of things.
Very cool. And Brian, before we get into the content, I got to ask you one other personal question here. And I'm sure there's a lot of folks who know you or know of you that are probably wondering this as well. When I went to your LinkedIn page, it says that you graduated from the New Siberian Institute in 1901. What are you, like 145 years old?
Never been to Siberia, and I've never graduated anything other than high school. You know, when I joined LinkedIn, it was some sort of era, and I wasn't able to remove it. And then I guess I can remove it now, and now I just kind of leave it up there as a testament to Siberia. So.
Okay, well, that really clears things up for me. I was often wondering, like, not only, like, where you were from, but maybe you weren't even from this planet, and that accounted for why you were, like, 150 years old. But anyway, let's get back to the content at hand. Amazon Pay has been around for a while, but last week they introduced something new, Amazon Pay Places. Give us an overview of what they announced, and I know you think this is going to have some really big impact. So after you give us the broad overview, tell us why you think this is going to be so impactful.
Well, thanks for the question. Amazon Pay Places is really an extension of Amazon Pay on the web. And, you know, what really typified Amazon's rise in the e-commerce space was the one-click patent, which ultimately Steve Jobs negotiated with Jeff Bezos, who's a patent holder, to use at the Apple store, essentially the iOS store ultimately, but on the iTunes store. And essentially what it did is it allowed somebody to have their payment credentials secured at the company's site and enact a one single click transaction to complete that that purchase. And it was contentious when the patent was issued, but ultimately it was granted to Amazon. Amazon Pay Places is an extension to that in the retail space. And the concept is really quite simple. It's really about the idea of being able to go into a retail store, possibly even surface that retail store inside the Amazon app, and to be able to have sort of a Amazon one-click experience in retail, where one could potentially self-scan a product and pay for it in real time, but could also just allow themselves at the cash register through notifications that they're at the specific facility that accepts Amazon Pay Places to actually complete the transaction.
So I think we lost Brian there for a second. Give him a second here to see if we get him back. If not, we'll just switch gears here and maybe just go straight to Travis and James Wester, who are waiting on deck here. And that's what we are going to do. So we'll wait. We'll get Brian back here. Our second segment, which will now make our first segment, wanted to talk about the other newsworthy item for this week was that the Fed Reserve announced or released its report on faster payments last week. And to get a broad overview of what's going on with that report, what's going on with faster payments and the impact that that's going to have, I'd like to welcome on Travis Delaney, the CEO and founder of Push Payments, and James Wester from IDC. Guys, are you on the line?
This is James.
James, excellent. And Travis, you were there too?
Absolutely.
Excellent. So, Travis, I want to start with you. Give us a little bit of a background on the Fed's report on faster payments. Why were they doing this, and what are the key findings or key recommendations from the report?
Absolutely, I'd love to. You know, when you look at the report, you can derive a lot of ideas from it. But what really had happened back in 2012, there was a report that the Fed had done about payments and about the structure, along with some of the fallacies of the system today, right? So, and ultimately that motivated the Federal Reserve to come around and let's go out to the industry and let them tell us what to do, right? So,
but Travis, you know, what to do about what? What was the pain point that they're trying to address here?
So here's the rub, right? I mean, the end of the game is in the U.S., our biggest asset, which is our maturity as a infrastructure and our economy, is our biggest Achilles heel. Because we are mature, we also have legacy systems. So in India and other parts of the world, Africa, you can keep, you know, Europe and so forth, you know, they didn't really have it at infrastructure, so it allowed them to jump ahead and in this idea of digitizing and really automation of the entire system, right? You remember, we're still running batch processes. Human errors are rampant, right? So all those things are, you don't even think about in the world of fintech today, but it is there, right? So that was part of the challenge. And some of the, you know, that's the root issue of it. But really, it comes down to it's a broken model. It doesn't, it worked for a time. It worked for a place and time, and not anymore. And ultimately, for us to be competitive in the global economy, and for us to evolve and realize the Federal Reserve is the banking infrastructure, right? The OCC came out last week and talked about what's wrong with it today. And some of it is that they can't get out of their own way in some cases, but that's regulation, that's legacy systems, and then the other one is security, right? So that's why there was actually two task forces, the Faster Payment Task Force and the Secure Payment Task Force, which I'm a member of both.
Okay, so what are the key recommendations from the Faster Payments Task Force?
So on this task force, it was broken in a couple categories, right? It talked about governance, it talked about infrastructure. And, you know, I think Karen actually said in an item from one of her articles earlier this week that it felt like a lot of the same what we have today. And so some of that is the way it's structured, but there's a lot of work that went into this. And there's some words like interoperability, right? You know, faster and speed is part of that, but it's not to be limited use. It should be available to everyone. So you have, you know, ambiguity is a word that was used a lot. Interoperability in whatever systems that was built, that was a key factor there. Well, in this new rail, which is how NACHA actually defines it, is it a, you know, what's the standards? What's the rules we're going to live by? What does it look like, right? And who owns it, right? So you got to look at the world today. We kind of have two worlds. We have the ACH and the wires and the banking systems of that, you know, the electronic interchange functions, and then we have the credit card retail payment side. And so they lived in two different rules. Now, you have PCI and cards, but is there any tokenization around a checking account number? How many of us have a checkbook sitting on the table, don't think anything about it that the routing and transit exposed, right? So there's a lot of double standards there. And so this effort actually allows for that all to come together and establish a digitized framework that not only moves faster, but it also reduces the friction that's there today, including fraud and including security, including items that, you know, in essence, that is the basis of things like interchange, risk, right? The reason why interchange exists today was originally because of a risk associated with a particular transaction, right? So that's the underpinnings of what went on, you know, but it was a lot of heated discussions. We had to build a framework of how to get to this, but ultimately, you know, there was discussions about building a directory, right, which is in the recommendations, you know, so that a directory, if you needed to get somebody, you didn't have to exchange card numbers. You didn't have to exchange tokenization values even. If you knew their identity and you could send them money or pull from them if they allowed for it, then you could have that interchange and it happened seamlessly without having 5, 6 dozen parties in between, all connecting and collecting a nickel basically to facilitate that transaction, right? So it was really an exercise where the entire industry came together to build a better model, build a better mousetrap, if you will. And we had everybody from consumer advocates to processors to large banks, small banks, medium-sized banks, everybody was represented, and anybody could have joined for that matter. So we had a lot of consultants, a lot of different viewpoints. And
all right, let's get James in and see here. James, is this going to help truly build this better system? And if it is, what do you see it being improved here?
That's a great question, and this is where I get to come in. One of the great things about being an analyst is you get to be a professional curmudgeon. So, you know, let me put on my curmudgeon hat. And you know, Travis gave a great overview of what the report was saying, but there are a couple of things that I note that were mentioned. Fraud is rampant. The system doesn't work, that we still use things that like legacy systems. And what's really amazing is that honestly, when it comes to security and fraud, it really isn't that rampant. I mean, we are talking about doing trillions and trillions of dollars, and this is just consumer payments, trillions and trillions of dollars, you know, billions of transactions, and we actually still measure fraud in basis points, which is pennies per hundreds of dollars. So is there something that we can do that's better? Absolutely. But does making that settlement happen faster solve that problem? Well, maybe, maybe not. And the idea that the system doesn't work, again, we're doing these trillions of dollars every year, and the system itself does work pretty well. Again, are there better ways to do it? Yes. But does faster settlement and does what the faster payment task force from the Fed really address those things that need to be fixed? I'm not certain. And the reason I'm not certain is because underneath all of this, and I think the part about risk is a fantastic thing that needs to be really understood. Payments is really about two things. It's about identity and it's about risk. It is, are you the person who has access to this credit or debit or bank account? And if you are, and I approve money on your behalf to go to somebody, and I give that approval, who's going to hold on to the risk while that settles? And right now it takes, you know, anywhere from 24 to, say, 72 hours for a payment to settle. And on credit, somebody's going to hold on to that, and they're going to charge for it. And like Travis said, it's going to be built into the interchange. Well, that risk, does it go away if we make it happen faster? Or do we just need to now recalculate how risk is put in there? Do we have to figure out new ways for counterparties in a transaction and the counterparty banks that are representing those two counterparties? Do we have to figure all of those things out? And I'm not certain that we've actually reached the point where, you know, we've answered sort of the general how this is going to happen, what we need to think about, when this needs to take place. But I'm still curious on some of the things like why. Why are banks going to want to do this? Are they going to want to do it out of the goodness of their own heart? No. They're going to have to build business cases. Is this going to interfere or cannibalize some of their current businesses in the card issuing or in wires or in money transfer? What products are going to be built on it that consumers are going to care about? Because I, as a consumer, if fraud happens, I have zero liability, so I don't really care. If I'm making a payment, do I care when my money settles out of my bank, or if I'm going to, say, my cable or my electricity provider or something else, do I just not want those shut off? Once I make that payment, do I really care when the settlement happens? As a consumer, I kind of don't. And so there are a lot of questions that, again, we've sort of answered the what, and we've kind of answered the how, and we've gotten a when, but that why question, I think, is still something that's really big that will take some time for, I think, everybody. And that was, you know, that the list that Travis provided of all the people who are involved in those transactions. It's going to take some time for those people to figure these things out, to figure those business cases out. Because, again, nobody's going to want to do this for free.
Yeah, James, I actually completely agree with you and a lot of those venues. I hope you don't mind, Ron. You know, the what and the why is a key component. Really, the document was meant to be guidelines to the what, and so that the how was really derived to the industry to come up with and resolve. But there's something that I think fundamentally, you mentioned about the consumer, which is so important to understand, especially in the world of the fintech today. You know, we've spent years building very good user interfaces, you know, between the mobile apps and so forth. So our consumers are used to, when we started this, we'd tell people what we do, people ask, and it's like, well, yeah, okay, so you move money from bank account to bank account. Big deal. So what? I have Venmo. I can do that. All right. So there's a perspective of virtual versus legacy. And so I view it as we've now basically built the demand of instant demand, instant gratification, on-demand needs. Amazon, we just talked about it, on-demand is their world. But our house is not in order. We basically created an expectation that we really can't deliver on, so it actually creates not only a rub from the process level, but it creates actually additional risk. which in some case you would think might be good because you can charge for that, but that's just the opposite. Think of Dodd-Frank and the compression of interest rate. You know, so that, you know, this is really about an industry play that fixes our house or inside, you know, taking care of our own utilities. And it's like setting people up for instant broadband, but not having the capabilities to deliver it, right? So, you know, unfortunately...
Travis, the issue I've got here, and I understand where you're coming from with it, but I think we're forgetting to throw in a very important issue here, which is at what cost? Because this could take billions of dollars of investment. Where is that coming from? Who is paying for that? You know, I look at this and I got to tell you, and some people are going to get pissed, this whole recommendation thing strikes me as some latent Obama-era techno fantasy kind of thing where everything's going to be digital and work great without really looking at who's actually going to pay for it and what the implications are for this. This proposal or these proposals, recommendations in this report would require the banks to, or somebody, to spend literally billions of dollars and then who knows how many millions of dollars for the banks to connect to it. Is the benefit that the system and consumers and merchants and whoever else reap from these recommendations outweigh the cost that it's going to take to get there?
So if you're looking for an answer or an insight, I can obviously share you my opinion, right? So, you know, from the outside, I totally agree with how you see the paper because that was actually some of the concerns we had when we were talking about it. The cost is not as much as you think. There's a lot of stuff that's been done in prep that allows for this faster aspect to happen. It is a challenge. It is a change of mindset. Like when we were talking, James, you had mentioned about the risk and some of the checks and balances and speed. Does it really help? Remember one thing, though. This is a good funds model. So it is a fundamental difference, which also changes the mindset of whether or not, and I know where Ron's going to go, it's, well, does the consumer really want that? So, for example, you're sending money directly, right? So why does it have to go out? You know, think about how retail works today and everything's around that. I hand somebody a $20, I purchase something, I take it back, right? And I take those goods and they have the value of those goods. So in a credit card world, it goes basically, let me go over here, let me put a hold on it, I'll be back to get my money 3 days later, you know, for the process. In the meantime, you walk out on a good faith with the goods, and then that merchant gets paid eventually. You know, sometimes next day, or sometimes 2 or 3 days, if it's over a weekend, even longer. So there's a cost to that liquidity also, right? So in a good funds model, the difference is the money moves. So it's right. Not a delay. There's not that dual processing. So it's a single message kind of approach where it's all in one shot. So you're moving the funds. It's no, none of this. Let me put a hold. Let me come back. Let me validate. And all that's done in line in the transaction in a matter of seconds. I mean, we go out, we do all kinds of KYC, OFAX, we do all kinds of AMLs and all kinds of BSA checks. We do all that in milliseconds, and still that transaction can get from one bank to the next under a second. You can't refresh the browser screen. Now,
right. And that is one of the things where I'll take off the curmudgeon hat, and I'll jump on the bandwagon here, and I will say that if you look at every other technology, and you can even look at, you know, UK and what they did with faster payments and how banks were a little resistant at first saying, you know, we don't want to cannibalize the products that we make a lot of money on with making money move fast. I mean, if you think about it, they were able to charge for somebody who might need to make a rent or a mortgage payment and they needed to make it right away. So, okay, we can charge a little bit more for that. So they're a little worried about it. But banks have actually found that they're able to build other products on it. They're able to do other things with that faster payment with that good funds model. And I do think that, again, if you look at other technologies and you say, well, you know, things work great now, we don't know what's going to happen. Well, take text messaging. We're probably all old enough to remember that when it used to cost you a nickel or 10 cents to send a text. And over time, the infrastructure was built up. Now we have text messaging that is a layer for customer service. It's a layer that we've built tools for actually moving money on. It's a layer that we do all kinds of stuff. And I think that the answer is, will we build products that will justify this cost? The short answer is yes. That's the way technology works. Is once you get the infrastructure in there, really smart people come along and say, okay, it's built. This is what we're going to do with it. And I think the a second answer to that is, I think money's actually already being spent. I think one of the things that when you're having a discussion about fintech, one of the things that's always mentioned is how banks aren't spending. They don't spend. They're not trying to update their systems. And that's just not true. I mean, we've looked at bank spend for decades, and the amount being spent on the equivalent of R&D, updating legacy systems, connecting into new payment rails, trying to tear down silos between lines of business, it's actually in the U.S., it's in the billions of dollars. So if the money is already being spent to connect into new rails and to make things more streamlined on the back end, and we have the impetus to change these things because we know that over time we'll be able to build better products that banks will be able to sell and you know, lower the costs on the back end and then make some money on new products on the front end. I do think that, yes, there is a justification. My feeling is I just think it takes a lot longer than we will expect it to do. So if we, you know, put faster payments in tomorrow, that doesn't mean the day after suddenly everything is from a business case standpoint, is perfect. It's going to take some time.
Oh, absolutely, right? Adoption is the only thing that happens in our industry that matters.
Right.
So we all know that unless people use something, it doesn't matter. You can have the beautiful product. You can have great technology. But if it's not fixing a problem and it's being used, who cares, right?
Right. And so, I do think
so
that's
Ron,
that
I would expect
part.
You to say that kind of thing.
Go ahead, James. What are you going to say?
I do think that's where the fintech, that part of the world, those non-traditional players who are coming from, say, a consumer electronics background or startups or a platform background, I do think that that's where they play a really interesting role in this discussion, in that they're the ones that are going to come in and say, oh, you've built this good funds model. You've taken risk out of there. So the only thing that differentiates your product from somebody else's is going to be, say, user experience. Guess what? That's what we do. We do user experience better than banks do. Let's show you how to do that. And suddenly now you have a really cool way to send money, or a really fast way to pay a bill, or PFM that can now automatically route funds or do something like that. And so I think once you do build those rails in there and you get all of the guts working, that's where I do think that fintech layer, those really smart people who are looking at financial services, who are looking at, you know, payments and insurance and all of the other things that we throw into the large bucket called financial services, that's where I think they have a really interesting role to play in this, where sure, it's going to take some time for the business cases to roll out, but boy, once they do, I think we may be really surprised how those fintech companies change things.
Hey guys, I hate to break in and cut this off, because it's been a great discussion and we could easily go a lot longer discussing the implications of the Fed report, but we are at the bottom of the hour and I do need to take a break. So thank you, Travis Delaney from Push Payments and James Wester from IDC for commenting on the faster payments news. And we're going to go to a break and we'll come back, and we've got Brian Romley back when we do. So just back in a minute.
Become our friend on Facebook. Post your thoughts about our shows and network on our timeline. Visit facebook.com/Voice America.
What do financial services of the future look like? Invisible yet ubiquitous, blended into our lives like air, gravity, this podcast. Temenos has specialized for 20 years in creating the best financial technology for thousands of financial institutions worldwide. Our open fintech marketplace allows millions of people to experience money in exciting new ways. Join the most vibrant financial services ecosystem in the world. Temenos, we make the money go round.
The future of online TV is here. View exclusive content from your favorite talk radio hosts and new programs that you can't see anywhere else. Visit voiceamerica.tv today.
Listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or join the conversation on Twitter by using the hashtag BreakingBanks. Now, back to the program.
Hey, welcome back to Breaking Banks. Just a reminder, Ron Shevlin here filling in for Brett King this week. And coming back to talk about Amazon Pay, we have Brian Romley back. Brian, welcome back.
Thank you for having me back, Ron. Sorry about that disconnect earlier today. California wildfire has affected my internet, so I'm back.
Ah, well, stay safe. Sorry to hear about that, but glad to have you back. We were in the middle of discussing what Amazon Pay places were, and I think you gave a pretty good description of it. And I know from reading your last post on Multiplex or readmultiplex.com that you're pretty bullish on it. Tell us what you think the impact of Amazon Pay places is going to be on consumers' payment behaviors.
It's a great question, Ron. You know, fundamentally, what Amazon is an aggregator of people's attention when they're shopping. And most people don't understand when you're buying on Amazon, 67 to almost 75% of transactions are with independent merchants. This is called the Amazon Marketplace. Amazon is going to bring that experience to retail. And that means discovery and channeling people to specific retail stores based on the product mix that that retail store might have. So it's sort of Amazon Prime on an instant, if you will. So someone might be searching for, I don't know, a certain athletic shoe, for example, and Prime might be able to deliver it in a few hours, but it might be around the corner at an independent merchant. So you can literally do the transaction and have it ready when you visit that retail store. That's one manifestation or embodiment of this, and it can go on. But essentially, it is just a new way to shop. It's a new payment modality. And I don't think it's going to so much eliminate all other forms of payment, frankly. I think it's going to enhance that, but it is definitely going to break some business models of some small acquiring operations, because some small merchants may be able to exist just with an Amazon Pay acceptance platform and of course, cash because of the number of Amazon users. So it's a big footprint and challenging to Visa and MasterCard ultimately at some point.
So but what I hear you saying is to really break this into two pieces, the shopping piece of it and then the payment piece of it. So from a retailer perspective, you can certainly see some negatives. I mean, if you've got to really hate the fact that if you've got somebody in your store, and you know that a lot of stores, they try to prevent the shopping online through the mobile device today to go find the better price. So you're just saying that Amazon's kind of enabling that. To a certain extent, the merchants can actually lose a customer who's already in their store for this. But I'm also not quite clear how it's going to change the payment behavior. Is Amazon going to replace the existing issuers and networks from a merchant perspective to enable a lower cost of payment for them?
I think we're going to see that definitely in the arc of things. Essentially, Amazon is probably in the best position to understand the financial strength of an individual as we stand in epoch 2017, especially people who have used Amazon quite frequently. We know exactly what their buying behavior is and potentially what their credit capabilities are. So it's just really a moving of the needle to start granting credit to those consumers. And at that point, we're really becoming a new payment modality. And it makes a lot of sense for Amazon to go that way. It may go in the direction of becoming a bank in a traditional legal sense, or it might be in a way of skirting those issues. I think time and regulatory environment might tell, but that will ultimately mean lower interchange and lower costs to merchants that use that platform. And to get back to your earlier point, if Amazon is sending me a customer to my business, from a perspective of the merchant, you probably, it's a love or hate kind of thing, but you're probably pretty happy to have that merchant in the business. So it might come with strings attached to it, but that's exactly what happened with Amazon Marketplace. And there are a lot of merchants that are happy to sell on Amazon's Marketplace. And now we have Whirlpool and Sears now giving their product up to the Amazon Marketplace or the Amazon site. So It's an interesting mix. I really have always believed that payments, marketing, and loyalty are always going to be wrapped up into a sort of communication dialogue. And it's part of my thesis on voice commerce, ultimately. And it's obviously the direction that Amazon is going in. And at some point, you'll just be able to say, Alexa, you know, I want this, and a local merchant will be able to deliver it. So it makes a lot of sense when you see it through that lens.
Well, let's talk more about voice commerce and voice first and move past Amazon, because I know that you've written some stuff about what Facebook is doing. What's your take on their response or reaction to the voice first revolution?
Wow. This is a completely different movement in this space. You know, Facebook really wants to get more active users and more daily active users. And by creating a Facebook appliance, if you will, a voice-first mediated 15-inch screen, high definition, high fidelity sort of Alexa show, if you will, what will happen is you have a way to interact with Facebook in a way that you haven't been able before. In this way, you're looking at the screen in this modality. You're looking at the screen for maybe glances and updates about what's going on your Facebook feed, but you're also navigating it with your voice. You might be making, you might pose a question like, what's my mom up to today? And she might be leaving statuses or pictures or, you know, if you're a grandmom or grandpa, what's my grandchildren up to today? And you can get a sort of stream. And it just becomes an appliance that you can go to specifically for consumption of Facebook. And of course, that's going to lead to voice commerce. It's going to lead to monetization levels that, frankly, we haven't even seen with Amazon yet. So it is an interesting entry. And what we're really talking about here is a rumor that more or less has been confirmed that a Chinese manufacturer is already in production for an Amazon voice first system. And they confirmed it does have a 15-inch screen. So it's not voice only, it's voice first mediated by a visual and maybe video sort of communication channel. Does that make sense?
Yeah, sure. 15 inches, though, I think is like the size of my TV. If not that big, then it's okay. Maybe certainly bigger than my Surface. And twice as big as my iPad. It seems like Facebook is going in the opposite direction of everybody else from a form factor, no?
Oh, yeah. Well, actually, 15 inches. I probably mumbled that over my voice here. So 15 inches, you know, a little bit larger than an iPad, obviously. And I think the reason for this is the consumption of video, entertainment, and pictures. You know, one could say maybe in a snarky way that it's going to be an automated voice first picture frame, and maybe in some regards it might look that way on the surface, but it's really AI into the home. And you know, I think really Facebook wants to become the AI platform, which is something that everybody is trying to drive, because obviously that's where it's all moving. We're moving out of a mobile-first world into an AI-operated world, and a voice is going to be the mediating way to communicate with the AI. That's why I call it voice first, because it's not really AI first, because there's no user interface until you have your voice. So that's how I think Facebook is, you know, kind of scheming to get into the home, and I think they're going to be very successful.
All right, one last question for you, Brian. I know you've been writing some stuff that we are post-PC. We are now getting into the post-smartphone-centric era. What's the next era, then, if it's post-smartphone?
It is really going to be a fracture of all of these technologies, but certainly we're going to see the rise of what I call the voice-first revolution. And that's where we're interacting with intelligent assistants that know, because of our context, what we want, so that we're not the endpoint of a Google search, that our intelligent assistant is doing that. So we're going to be interacting with technology in a much different way. It's going to be more ephemeral and more directed by pretty much something that we would imagine a human would be doing on our behalf, but it's going to be done by the AI. It's probably the easiest way to put it in a short space, if you will.
Excellent. Thanks, Brian. Where can everybody find you?
Readmultiplex.com. Come and subscribe. And I'm at Brian Romley at Twitter.com. And just excited to interact with anybody. I love hearing dissenting questions, too. So please reach out to me.
Thanks, Brian. Appreciate you being on. And
thank you.
All right, we are now going to go to an interview that I conducted recently with Julie Conroy, the research director at ITE Group, about the impact of AI and machine learning on fraud protection. We're about halfway through the year of 2017, and when we look back at the end of this year, it's pretty clear that artificial intelligence, or AI, is going to be one of the hot, if not the hottest topic in banking for the year. And one of the big impacts that AI has is on the world of fraud management, fraud protection, and fraud prevention. And with us today is one of the leading analysts in this space, Julie Conroy from ITA Group. Julie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Ron.
You bet. So, Julie, you and I worked together for a number of years, and I was at ITA Group for a long time, but I'm sure we've got a lot of listeners who are not familiar with ITA. Can you tell us a little bit about what ITA Group is and what you do?
Sure. ITA Group is a financial services research and consulting firm. We focus on how technology changes, regulatory changes, and business strategy is impacting how folks in the financial services world are evolving their business.
Great. You recently published a report that was titled Machine Learning for Fraud Mitigation, the Substance Behind the Buzz. And I'm going to ask you a lot about what your findings and conclusions and the implications on the world of banking is. But I got to tell you, one of the things that hit me immediately was your use of the term machine learning in the title instead of artificial intelligence. Was there a reason why you did that? And is there the two things different? And if so, how?
Yeah, that was intentional. So, yeah, both are very buzzy topics right now. I see machine learning as a subset of artificial intelligence. And so artificial intelligence is this umbrella concept that refers to a variety of different technologies that can help make processes better, help make technologies better. It encompasses natural language processing, the robo-advisors, all of that kind of stuff. Machine learning is a very specific subset in which you have advanced analytics that have the ability to iteratively optimize. And by iterative optimization, it means that they are learning as they go. This can be models that can train themselves. It can be models that can be rapidly iterated by a data scientist or a human being, or it can be a combination of both. And it's that specific subset of AI where we're seeing a lot of actual, very substantive results in financial services specific to the fraud prevention use case.
My understanding has been that AI has been used in the world of fraud management for probably 30 years or so. What's different about what's going on right now? How is it better than what's been done in the past?
So you're right. The concept of using machine learning for fraud prevention has been around for decades. It goes back to the first neural network models back in the early 90s. What is different now is that we have this confluence of advanced modeling techniques, and so it's no longer a whole bunch of data scientists that are copying things down from academic journals to create their models. We now have Google, which is making modeling tools available for free. We have universities that are churning out just ranks of data scientists that can use these tools, and even with all of the data scientists entering the field, we still have a dearth of supply because the demand is so high. And we're at a point where data storage costs are at an all-time low. So if you look back to the mid-80s, it cost $40,000 to store a gigabyte of data. And the server was the size of a refrigerator. Today, thanks to advances in technology as well as the cloud, it's about 2 cents per gigabyte. And so that means that we don't have to pick and choose what data we use to inform the analytics. We can throw a whole bunch of data against the wall and have these machine learning models, spin through it very quickly to determine which are the predictive variables that will work. And that's a big change.
So where's the benefit? Is the benefit on the fraud prevention side? Is it more on the detection after the fact? Where is machine learning having the biggest impact?
Where I'm seeing the low-hanging fruit with the use cases is really on the detection side. and it's the ability to speed the detection of new attack vectors, new tactics being used by the fraudsters. And in fraud, the phrase time is money truly applies, because the quicker that you can find how they're getting you and the quicker that you can develop analytics that can adjust and detect these patterns of attack, the less money that's going to go out the door. The other factor that we're seeing is if you can have more precision in your models, because you have the ability to evolve them more rapidly, you also have the benefit of fewer false positives, which, as I talk to both banks as well as merchants, the false positive impact is oftentimes the greater concern, because you're inconveniencing your good customers.
Are there any particular financial institutions or merchants that you think are kind of leading the way here in terms of using AI or machine learning for fraud detection?
You know, if I named names, nobody would ever talk to me again. That's why people are generally so willing to talk to researchers, is that we do so under the promise of confidentiality. I could say, in speaking in generalities, as you look at the financial institutions, as you look at the merchants, it's generally the largest that are the furthest along with this and are throwing the most resources against it. Although, there are some regional banks that are also doing some really interesting things from an analytics perspective as well.
Okay, so don't mention the names, but what is it that they're actually doing? Is it the modeling side? What is it that they're doing? If they're using different new data sources, what specifically, what data are they actually using to do this? So don't mention the names, but give me a flavor for what exactly are they doing that makes it so different and interesting?
So as you look at, first from a data perspective, it's no longer just the traditional structured data fields that are being analyzed here. It's also the unstructured data that you can bring into the models. And it's everything from, social media streams to, the navigational behavior that somebody is engaging in with a website. You can bring data from across channels and across products to provide more context for the transaction. And by bringing in all of this data that can give more context to a transaction, you can have a much better decision. And, this is one very concrete example that a bank gave me. Typically, traditional fraud models, if you see that you have three different credit card transactions happening in the same day across three different states at three different gas stations, the third one is going to get declined, because that is just clearly a pattern that is indicative of fraud. However, if you're able to bring in the context from that customer's application where they told you when they opened up the account that he's a truck driver, then all of a sudden that context makes that transaction look quite normal. And so by applying context to transactional analysis, you can not only detect more fraud, but you can also bring down those false positive declines.
Got it. Julie, you alluded a couple minutes ago to the fact that you think it's the larger institutions that are kind of leading the way and doing stuff here. But yet, here in the U.S., we've got more than 10,000 mid-sized and small financial institutions who generally rely pretty heavily on vendors for their technology support and solutions. What's a mid-size or even smaller institution do? What can they do? Do they have to just sit back and wait for their vendors to come to the table with some sort of AI or machine learning solutions? Or are there things that they can be doing themselves from a build perspective?
If the smaller institutions need to talk to their processors to understand what technologies are available to them. The processors are also engaging very heavily in these, because there's a recognition that while traditionally we've said that fraud is not a competitive issue because we're all up against the same set of bad guys, what's emerging with the early adopters of these technologies is that fraud actually has the potential to be a competitive issue, because you can provide a better customer experience because you're not doing the false positive declines, while at the same time bringing down your expenses by detecting more fraud. And so a number of the processors have partnered with machine learning vendors to bring these types of analytics to their smaller bank clients. So, you know, a couple of examples, you have First Data that has partnered with a firm and it has embedded machine learning analytics into a couple different aspects of its platform. Similarly, TSYS has partnered with Featurespace, and they also are making these capabilities available to their institutions. So there's a number of different ways in which smaller institutions can also ride this machine learning wave.
Okay, last question, Julie, as you kind of look to the future here, are we really going to see any reduction in fraud as a result of artificial intelligence and machine learning technologies?
I think that actually for the first time in a while, we're seeing an opportunity to keep pace with this rapidly rising wave of cybercrime. The one gating factor we're still going to have is that institutions will continue to need to do business cases before they can embed new technologies. If you're bringing in a net new vendor, then you have to go through the vendor risk management process, which is lengthy. So the challenge that we're still up against is we finally have technologies that can help. It's a matter of helping institutions to get more nimble and adopt these technologies more rapidly.
Great. Julie, thanks a lot for being with us today. If people want to purchase the report, where can they find it?
They can go to aitegroup.com, AITEgroup.com, and you can find it there, and there's a path to purchase there.
Great. Thanks, Julie.
Great. Thanks, Ron.
All right, back to live, and what would a Breaking Banks episode be without a moment of snark? So from what I can tell from reading the banking press and blogosphere, customer service departments and banks seem pretty ready and willing to shut down all of their existing service approaches and rely on artificial intelligence. But will AI-driven customer service truly provide superior customer service? Is anybody actually testing this? I was thinking about this recently while I was at the airport. I was traveling from Des Moines to Chicago on a 4 o'clock flight. I went to the gate agent and asked if the 222 flight was full. It wasn't. Plenty of seats available. So I said, great, can I switch flights? Yes, but because you have no status on the airline, Mr. Shevlin, it will cost you $75. Seriously, you can't waive the fee? No. So I stayed with my 4 o'clock flight. In the end, the airline didn't get the $75, and the whole experience pissed me off. I will be sure to not choose that airline every chance I get, and I get lots of chances. So here are the key questions. Did the gate agent make the right decision? And would AI-driven customer service have made a different decision? I mean, would AI-driven customer service have said, sure, Mr. Shevlin, no problem, in an effort to build goodwill and bet that I wouldn't have paid the extra fare? Look, simply providing data-driven answers to easy questions is not a demonstration of AI's potential to provide superior service. The test has to come from making hard and often data-starved decisions. You know, there's another thing that makes me question whether AI-driven customer service will truly deliver superior results. AI needs data. For AI algorithms to self-correct or self-adjust over time, the tools have to have access to the results of the decisions, recommendations, or prescriptions that the tools make. But banks don't have that data. In fact, I don't even hear anybody talking about how to capture it. Nevertheless, that doesn't seem to stop anybody from claiming that AI customer service is going to be the answer to all of banking's prayers. I think we need to test that hypothesis. I'm Ron Shevlin, Director of Research at Corner Advisors, with this week's Moment of Snark on Breaking Banks. So guys, thanks a lot for listening. Don't forget to subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And don't forget to leave a great review for us. And we will all see you next time here on Breaking Banks. Thanks a lot.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time, for more of the latest in fintech news.